This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN. Pete Zimmerman's the producer. Hi, it's John Williams. We're here till 1 o'clock. Anna DeVlantis will inform and entertain you. There have been interesting things going on in the Congress, and there's always news about, well, pick a topic these days. We're going to talk a little bit about the business scene right now. We'll start with John Najarian, who joins us Tuesdays at this time. John is the founder of MarketRebellion.com, the financial news education and subscription site. Hey, John, welcome back.
Great to be with you, John. Thank you.
Orion just alluded to the fact that we hit an all-time high. We were about 50 points shy of 30,000 on the Dow. All the indices doing really well, even if they take a breather today. And I guess most of this because of a second vaccine, huh?
Yeah, and there's probably going to be a third, a fourth, a fifth, and a sixth. And the good news about this one, just as you and I finished up last week saying, well, some of the impediments to the widespread distribution of this particular Pfizer vaccine with BioNT, that was that it has to be kept at minus 90 Fahrenheit, minus 70 Celsius, I believe, or some crazy numbers like that. And then it's extremely effective, but obviously that presents some challenges. This one apparently is also stored at very, very low temperatures, but once you start distributing it, you can keep it in refrigeration units that are just above freezing. Obviously, much easier, and many more of those sort of units available. So I think that is another reason that people were a little more enthused. But the more of these that we have, and who knows what the next one is, John. Maybe the next one's 96 or 97%, because these numbers are staggeringly good.
Yeah, no kidding. So the market and people's, I think, attitudes are up. I did see this. Value stocks have rallied recently following some of this news. What's a value stock? How long does that last? What does that mean to you?
Well, so, for instance, a steel stock might be that. Energy stocks like BP and ExxonMobil might fall into that category. Rather than the growth stocks that we were talking about, the hypergrowth even with the FANGs, these other stocks have truly outperformed. Last week they were up 6% against the NASDAQ that was negative on the week. Now some members of the NASDAQ were still fine for the week, but overall the QQQ, one of the ways of tracking that NASDAQ, was negative for the week. And meanwhile, we had an almost 7% rally in the small caps, which are more or less the IWM, the Russell IWM. It's 2,000 small cap stocks. And they've been off to the races. Today, they're taking a breather, like you said.
Does that portend a more enduring economic recovery that value stocks are up? If steel and energy stocks are doing well, if Caterpillar's doing well, that tells you more than just, oh, a quick blip. That says something down the road, doesn't it?
Yes. They are hoping that, and, you know, you've already seen some of the stocks lose a little of their luster, if you will. Everything from Zoom to Teladoc and even Apple. But they're all still up dramatically on the year. But it's somewhat tempting, I guess, to pare back some of your gains in those and invest in some of the stocks, in particular those banking stocks that were down 30% or more on the year. And getting into those and getting out of something where you have a nice big fat profit without getting out of altogether, just lightening up the percentage, might make a lot of sense to a lot of us.
Well, what does this mean to you? SoftBank is stockpiling cash. I won't try and pronounce his name, but the founder and CEO of SoftBank said today the investing conglomerate will spend much of the year selling assets in order to sustain liquidity in the case of a second coronavirus wave and further economic damage from the pandemic. I wonder if the market is doing well and we are going to have another dip eventually, if investors would start to pull some of their stuff off.
Sure, and I think you've seen a number of folks famously doing extraordinarily bad trying to time that market. Because, for instance, some of these big investors have said, I'm selling everything. I'm going to cash. This is just ahead of the election. Well, obviously, they missed a pretty substantial rally on that move. Now, if they were smart enough, lucky enough to not make that mistake, maybe they would take a little bit off the table here and then look for better entry points if indeed one presents itself. I think if you don't see, John, significant tax increases, that the market is going to love almost everything else about what it sees. The vaccines being applied, perhaps even just ahead of the end of the year, but obviously not in mass quantities for months, but still moving out there in the right direction, and extremely low interest rates. And today's retail sales numbers do nothing to move the Fed off of their lower for longer, maybe lower forever stance that they're in right now.
Yeah, real estate is sure doing well. What about this? Do you think that this news about the vaccines is enough to get us over the hump without another round of stimulus, or do we have to have more stimulus?
I do think it is enough. I wish, John, that they, and you and I have talked about it extensively, that I thought they should have come to a meeting somewhere, and if the best the Senate could pass was $1 trillion, which is $250 billion more than they did during the financial crisis, when Pelosi was the head of the House and they were trying to shore up our finances. If they turned down $1 trillion that they could have had in August, then I'd say I don't see any reason to put it out now. The pain is already out there. The businesses that are going to close are already closing. You know, it's very, very frustrating. And we pounded the table for this and said, this is what we should have done, but they didn't do it. So you got to, as they say, dance with the one that brung you, or, you know, you got to trade the market you got, not the one you want.
Yeah.
I think they should have done it, John. They didn't. I think if they did it now, it would be sugar high. A rush of capital would go into everybody, all the infrastructure stocks and all that. And then what next? All of a sudden, we've got another $2 trillion in debt, or have to work our way out of that. So I don't think that's the solution at this point.
I won't say you're an outlier on that, but you know not everybody agrees with you on that, John.
Oh, yeah, I know. I hear, you know, all the Fed folks, virtually all of them, you know, from Jay Powell all the way down, saying, you know, Congress has got to do something. I agree. They should have done something.
Right, right, right.
But it's kind of like, well, I should have treated that cancer when it was stage two. Now that it's stage four, you know, the ones that are going to die, and these are businesses we're talking about, not humans, are going to die. And that is sad and despicable that Congress let them twist in the wind from the end of the stimulus, which was July 31st, till now.
Yeah, so
but
if it's not,
now,
yeah.
I don't think you save any of them by throwing money at the problem now.
Right, if it's not too little, at least it's too late, says John Najarian. Interesting take on that. John, thanks for visiting with us. It's John Najarian, founder of MarketRebellion.com. We'll talk next week, sir. Talk a little bit more about what it's like in the workplace going forward with a new administration. The president of SciFarth at Work is Philip Weiss. He's joined us before, and he joins us again. Philip, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, John.
Hadn't thought about it from this perspective. Will we see a difference? I mean, I could see fighting the pandemic or the economy, but will we see a different world in the office with a new administration?
Yeah, the answer is unquestionably yes. And to your point, John, it may not be the headline story it would have been in any other new administration's tenure. And that's for the simple reason that we've got higher level emergencies and issues to deal with. But President-elect Biden has telegraphed for the last several months, if not before, that he's looking to enhance employee rights and make employers more accountable on a number of fronts. So we may not see these as the contentious arguments that we otherwise might have, but it's going to be a key focus for the administration.
Give me an example. I mean, how would it be different?
So what's interesting is we're going to first see Biden initially state, here are my priorities, such as raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour, such as ensuring that unionized employees have greater ability to strike and non-union employees have a greater ability to form unions. So in every key area, from paid leave to immigration to workplace discrimination, he's going to start to telegraph his priorities. But the next piece, John, is what's kind of the order of action? And we won't know that really till January, because whether the Senate flips blue, so to speak, using the vice president's tie-breaking vote or not, is going to answer whether we have a lot of legislative changes. But even without a Democratic majority in the Senate plus a tie-breaking vote, the president can engage in executive orders, and he's already sending signals, for example, to plaintiffs' lawyers all over the country that as a public policy imperative, I'm looking to protect employer rights, and I'm already getting calls from plaintiffs' lawyers telling me behind the scenes, we are beginning to sort of restock the pipeline in terms of cases we wouldn't otherwise have teed up. So we're going to see a lot of that come out in the next year.
Would there be a measurable impact on businesses in terms of profitability or productivity as a result?
Not initially, which probably is going to give business owners a certain amount of relief, anticipatory relief. But the reality is, the requirement for employers is to be far more cautious than they may have been given COVID, given the Republican administration over the last year to 4 years. So when you look at a Democratic administration, many more cases are based on what you might consider to be less obvious or subtle mistakes. Those mistakes by managers and bosses are now going to be front and center in a lot of cases. For example, under the Obama tenure, we dealt with a lot of companies that got sued for using what we might call simple buzzwords inappropriately, calling a candidate overqualified without any intention to say the wrong thing. But courts, agencies, state bodies said, you know what, a term like that implies that you might think this person is just too old for the job as opposed to not qualified for the job. Those kind of cases are far more common when you have a Democratic administration with its priorities being laid out. So even an issue like that, a mistake like that, wrong terminology, inferences of discrimination, they become far more dangerous in a Democratic tenure.
Well, nobody wants to champion discrimination, but I don't know what the appetite is for that sort of prickly view of language. Sometimes it's coded and it means something. Sometimes it's an honest mistake and it just makes for a kind of an uncomfortable work environment. I don't know which side of that issue I would fall on.
Yeah, you're like basically articulating a debate that's been ongoing among legal scholars in the employment sphere for decades. The good news is cases rarely rest on one statement, one oversight. But it is really important to let your managers know that patterns of those kinds of slips of the tongue, omissions, can add up in a Democratic administrative time period. We had another case which is really interesting. It was more than one word, John. It was a manager at a waste company that was dissuading female employees from working in a certain shift where they had to operate a sludge pump, thinking that female employees would be less comfortable getting sludge all over themselves. That was the highest paid shift on the waste company's project. And this manager said, you know, I don't think you want to get dirty. You know, a woman like you does not want to get sludge all over her. Now, that's a little bit more than a word. It's a whole phrase. It's a decision about employment, and it costs the company. So it starts with single words, but it can move into entire employment decisions.
Okay, I guess it just I'm processing some of that. I guess it just depends on how it shakes out, right? If somebody is doing what you just did, denying somebody a better paying job because of their gender, then I don't think anybody needs to explain what a mistake that is. But if the intention of that person were not to deny them money, but simply to accommodate them, to afford them a more pleasant task, I'm still not sure what a judge or jury should say about that. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And what you just articulated is what ends up being discussed in court.
Yeah.
Meaning, did the employee actually tell her, in this case her, or his manager, this is the kind of job I want. This is the kind of environment I want to work in.
Yeah.
These are the conditions I'm looking for. Absent that, it becomes an assumption by the manager, and that's where the risk comes in. So if the kind, if there's an area here that really has not been focused on at all in the last 4 years, that we already are hearing is going to become more important. So it's not only what laws Biden gets passed or what orders he ends up enacting. It is a focus of the plaintiff's bar that we should at least be aware of.
Well, Philip Weiss is aware of it. He's the president of Seyfarth at Work, and this is what they do. Seyfarth.com, that's spelled S-E-Y-F-A-R-T-H, Seyfarth.com. Nice to talk to you, Philip, as always. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, John.
Let's visit now with Greg McBride. Greg's been with us before, chief financial analyst for Bankrate. Greg, welcome back to WGN Radio and the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Thanks for having me back. Great to be with you.
John Najarian and I were talking a moment ago in part about real estate and just how busy and positive some of the numbers are. There's a new survey from Bankrate that finds that 27% of mortgage holders do not know what their interest rate is. Obviously, over one in four of us don't know what we're paying and maybe paying too much, huh?
Yeah, especially in a year like this where we've seen record low mortgage rates, not knowing your rate, you know, means perhaps not recognizing what a great opportunity this is. Now, if you don't know your rate, that's fine. It's important to know how to find it. Check your account statement. Call the company that you make your payments to every month. They'll be able to tell you what that rate is. If you're paying a rate 3.5% or more, this is an opportunity to look into refinancing. We're seeing plenty of people refinancing at 2.75, you know, with no points. I mean, just to get these sub 3% rates, not something I expected to see in my lifetime, that's for sure.
Yeah, it's amazing. Think about that. Think about what you just said. If you're paying 3.5, you're paying too much. But your horizon matters, right? That is, if you have closing costs, and you will, either you're going to pay them or they're going to get rolled in, then you need to figure out how long before you earn those back, right?
That is exactly right. And it has to, you know, obviously mesh with how long you plan to be in the home. If you're, you know, planning on moving in a few years, it's probably not going to be worth it. But if this is a place you plan to be for the foreseeable future, the drop in rates is so significant that you can probably earn back those closing costs within a year or two. You know, people often sort of get this deterred from refinancing because of those upfront costs. It's one of the most common reasons people cite when they don't refinance. But look at the big picture. What you pay out in closing costs, even if you can't roll the costs in, what you pay out, you're going to get a chunk of that back after closing. You'll have a month without a mortgage payment. And then the escrow account you had at your old lender, that's going to get refunded to you. So you'll get some of that back. And the bigger picture of what is your total savings going to be over the course of the next 10 years, your savings might be five times what you paid at closing, you know, 10 times or 15 times that over the life of a loan. So important to think in those terms.
One of our sponsors here and a colleague, David Hochberg, is in the business of mortgages, and he was working with me on whether or not I should refi. And he said, all you got to do is get this. And then he listed about 12 documents. And I just said, that sounds like the third ring of hell, finding all of those statements, getting them updated. Do you have any sympathy for the people who know that the savings are right there, but sometimes the process can be painful?
It is a process. There's no denying that. You know, some of the concerns that people have about the paperwork, the hassle, the fees, not without merit, that's for sure. And it's a process that tends to own you for a while, but you know, taking a step back and just kind of looking at the potential savings afterwards, you know, that can help sustain you. Yes, it really does help to have as much of that paperwork put together ahead of time as possible. That way you're not holding up the process and dragging out longer than it has to be.
Is anybody doing ARMs anymore then?
No, it's funny. A lender I know, he said to me not that long ago, he said, I can't even remember the last time I did an adjustable rate. And that's with good reason. You know, normally there is a lower rate on an adjustable than what you get on a fixed, and that's but kind of tempts people to go in that direction. They get a lower rate for a period of years before it starts to adjust. Well, now there is no differential. We see lenders pricing the ARMs and the fixed rate loans right about the same. So in that sense, why take the risk, right? Just go with the certainty of the fixed rate mortgage.
What's the difference between a jumbo loan and a traditional loan right now?
It's about a third of a percentage point. That spread, you know, really expanded earlier this year whenever financial markets were really tight in the early days of the pandemic. It's come down since then. Jumbo rates are at record lows in their own right. So, you know, whether you've got a jumbo loan or a smaller conforming loan, great refinancing opportunity either way.
Are more people financing mortgages or refinancing the ones they have? You know, new homeowners or just people staying in the same house?
It's predominantly refinancing. Now, that being said, home sales are at a 14-year high, so you're seeing heightened activity on both ends of the equation. But the refinancing activity has definitely been dominating the market this year.
Do you have any advice on buying down the points, putting money up front just like you used to in the old days, or is that not worth it right now?
Yeah, you have to do the count. The way the numbers usually work is you pay 1 point, that's 1% of the loan amount. It buys down your interest rate by about a quarter of a percentage point. Now, that often takes about 5 or 6 years to break even, to earn that back. And when you layer that on top of the closing costs, it kind of turns people off, right? I mean, that's a chunk of cash. So, you know, it pays to do the calculation, but then I also think you have to look at your overall financial situation. Do you really want to be parting with that much cash right now, knowing it's going to take several years to earn it back, at least as far as any points you pay are concerned?
Well, you make me think with that statement about somebody else I know who was borrowing money to buy a house for the first time recently. Rates were so low, they wanted to keep some of the cash on hand that they have. So they had money for a down payment and then some. Rather than throw a lot of money into that down payment, they kept some cash in reserve and borrowed the rest just because the rates were so low. What's your thought about that strategy?
Well, that's the refinancing equivalent of people doing what's called a cash out refinance. So they, you know, they have a lot of equity in their home, and so they refinance and they're actually able to take some more money out and still stay at a low enough loan to value ratio that they get a very competitive rate. You know, that can be a sound financial strategy as long as you're prudent about it. You're not over leveraging yourself. You know, I know a money manager in particular that, you know, every time the rates go down and he's got equity in his house, he does a cash out refinance and invests the money in the stock market. But that's what he does for a living. You know, if you're sort of, you know, borrowing that money, using the house like an ATM, as we saw back in the housing boom, that didn't end well. So I think you have to look at your overall, you know, financial habits. Look yourself in the mirror. Are you going to make prudent use of that cash? But the idea of using somebody else's money, you know, borrowing at a rate of sub 3% on a fixed rate basis over the next 30 years is pretty tempting.
I'll let you go, Greg, but what's the, I don't know if you want to answer this, but I'll give you mine. I think the first house I bought, we were thrilled we were able to borrow the money at about 11%. The rates
had come, probably mid-80s, I'm guessing.
Yeah, right. The rates had come down. I thought I was a genius. I think I got it at 10.5. And I thought, well, now who's pretty clever now? Mr. 10.5 here.
Imagine we've been that. Spoiled, haven't we? It's, you know, really, you know, rates have been kind of on a downward trajectory for the better part of the last 35, almost 40 years now. And so, people have refinanced again and again and again just because we've seen these successive lows, particularly in the last 15 or 20 years.
Now, the flip side of that is, though, that you can't invest money into something that's secure and get a great return on it either, right? So we're borrowing for less, but we're making nothing on passbook savings, whatever those are.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, there's always going to be a differential. The mortgage debt's always going to cost you more than what the bank is paying to bring that money in.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, particularly now with rates as low as they are, the savings, it's, you know, almost insult to injury that your return is that far behind even the rate of inflation.
CFA Chief Financial Analyst for Bankrate.com, Greg McBride. Thanks, Greg.
Thanks for having me, John. Appreciate it.
More business news on the Wintrust Business Lunch with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Walgreens shares have been down nearly 9% after Amazon announced the launch of a digital pharmacy and discounts for Prime members. It's called Amazon Pharmacy and lets people order medication through a section of its retail site or via mobile app. Shoppers can pay using their health insurance. Prime members who don't use their insurance are eligible for discounts of generic and brand-name drugs on Amazon's site or at about 50,000 participating pharmacies. Schaumburg-based Paylocity is buying SamePage for an undisclosed amount. Paylocity is a human resource and payroll software maker. SamePage sells software for workers to manage tasks, communicate with coworkers, and share files. Paylocity recently hit the 9th position on Fortune's 100 fastest-growing companies list. Plans are being drawn up for a new 27-story, 383-unit residential tower in Fulton Market District. Crane says the proposed site is at the corner of Randolph and Elizabeth Streets, just west of McDonald's headquarters. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Amy Guth joins us again. Amy, let's start with, because we don't have Amazon in our lives enough, let's let's start with what Amazon is doing with a sort of digital pharmacy.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So it was very big news earlier today that Amazon announced that they are launching a digital pharmacy, and it's going to, it'll be, you know, ordering your prescriptions online. It'll also discounts for Amazon Prime members in the U.S., but that set off some shockwaves through other drugstore, you know, players in that space. We saw immediate reaction, you know, from Walgreens, who's based here. You know, we saw their shares go down pretty quickly. So it's interesting because it puts Amazon in a space with things like Walmart. Now, Walmart.com is a big competitor for Amazon. We saw Walmart launch something like Amazon Prime, Walmart Plus. We saw them do that to keep up. So things are really getting tense between them. One advantage that Walmart has had over Amazon is the prescription space, right? Because here's, you know, Walmart, you can buy a TV and a pair of pants and your prescription pills and get everything done kind of in one stop. Amazon had that one piece missing. They did have a relationship with PillPack. They had acquired them about 2 years ago for a little over $750 million. But you still had to do the transactional part off of Amazon on the PillPack site. This changes that, so this will be right there on the Amazon site. I think it's going to be interesting because what they really stressed is that they are going to really err on the side of transparency. So they're going to display when you're checking out both the price when using insurance and your price without it, so that they're really disclosing a lot of information about drug prices. So how they compete, you know, that we all know that filling a prescription at one pharmacy versus another can sometimes mean quite a bit of savings. So it'll be interesting to see how they compete, how their prices compete in that space. But other pharmacy chains who've really been struggling, immediately we saw a hit to them, CVS and Walgreens, of course, the two biggest in the U.S.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to me, the bottom line. Well, maybe it's not this simple. Are the prices lower on Amazon? Maybe they would be, but it's different, as you said, than just buying a pair of blue jeans mm-hmm. from this place or that. It's prescriptions. They need to be sent to someplace. Sometimes records need to be transferred. Will people be willing to do that? But I suppose if the price is good enough, maybe so, huh?
Yeah, and that's the point that Bloomberg had raised in their reporting on this, about exactly how willing people might be to go to Amazon for this, because it stands to reason, you know, people go into Walmart and you get all, or a Target or whatever, you get all your stuff kind of in the same place. But because Amazon came up in the digital space, not in the brick-and-mortar space, will people be as willing, especially right now when sometimes changing pharmacies can mean getting a new prescription, going to an office visit with your doctor at a time when people are trying to keep that to a minimum, things yeah. like that. So yeah. It'll be interesting to see how that plays out. I'll be watching that closely for sure.
1 minute, Amy. What are the highlights of the Jack Dorsey, Mark Zuckerberg testimonies before the Senate today?
Yeah, the New York Times has a wonderful live blog that they've been updating, and they've been under fire, really, from both parties, particularly Dorsey. You know, it's all around misinformation, the 2020 election, how content was moderated, who moderated it, and how and why, and wanting more transparency around that. I'll be watching that for the rest of the day because I think this has been, you know, a lot of pundits are kind of saying, hey, this has been a long time coming. It's about time. And some people are saying we need more regulation. Some people are saying we just need more transparency. So it's very interesting how they're, but, you know, so far both CEOs are kind of just defending their positions about how they've proceeded. And one of them likened the telephone, saying, well, you can't hold the phone company, you know, responsible for misinformation spreading. That's done by human beings. And, of course, then that comes in, the moderation and who gets moderated and censored and why. So a lot of news that will be coming out of this, I'm sure, but I will keep watching and I'll keep you posted.
That's Amy Guth. That's the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks, Amy.